This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hadrian's Wall by Adrian Goldsworthy, narrated by Derek Perkins. Introduction. Just when you think you are at the world's end, you see a smoke from east to west as far as the eye can turn, and then, under it, also as far as the eye can stretch, houses and temples, shops and theatres, barracks and granaries, trickling along like dice behind, always behind, one long, low, rising and falling, and hiding and showing line of towers. And that is the wall. "Ah," said the children, taking breath. "You may well," said Parnassius. "Old men who have followed the eagle since boyhood say nothing in the empire is more wonderful than first sight of the wall." I suspect that hearing my father read these words to my brother and me at bedtime was the first time that I saw the wall. These days Kipling is not very fashionable, so I wonder how many children hear or read Puck of Pook's Hill. But I remember loving these stories of English history, and most of all the three chapters where Parnassius, centurion of the 30th Legion, tells his story. The Romans have always had an appeal for me that is hard to explain, although part of it is that they came to where I lived, which made them somehow more real and part of my history. Parnassius was a likable hero, as much a first-rate British subaltern in late 19th-century India as he was a Roman officer, and his story was full of wars and battle, which always have a great pull on a boy's imagination. Reading the story now, some of it is odd, such as the appearance of the winged hats, Vikings, a few centuries early, to dominate the Picts and lead them against Hadrian's Wall, which they then try to capture tower by tower. Yet, as is often the case with Kipling, there are moments where you still feel that he found the essence of a time or place, and this passage is one of them. His wall is a bit higher than the real thing, while so far there is no trace of a Roman theatre along it, and we now know that by the late 4th century, when the story is set, the civilian settlements outside forts were greatly diminished or had vanished altogether, and most of the turrets had been demolished. Even so, the picture he paints of a bustling, raucous community of soldiers and civilians drawn from all of the empire and now living on its distant northern frontier probably contains a lot of truth for much of the wall's history. In the years after hearing Parnassius's story, I have read more about the wall, starting, while still very young, with Lady Bird's Julius Caesar and Roman Britain, in which I crossed out the H from the label on the maps behind its front and back covers to rename the structure Adrian's Wall. At the time, this seemed hilarious. Later, I moved on to ever more serious and scholarly works. My first visit came after wheedling my parents into diverting from the quickest route on the return journey from a family holiday in the north of Scotland. Decades later, I am still reading and still learning, and have visited sites on the wall many times, but that first glimpse described by Parnassius to the children in the story is always at the back of my mind. Hadrian's Wall is special, not only to those of us interested in ancient Rome and the Roman army, but more widely. Hadrian's Wall began approximately AD 122, and on which work continued for much of the next two decades, stretched for some 73 miles, 118 kilometres, from coast to coast across northern Britain. Although this is impressive, in size it is dwarfed by the complex of fortifications making up what we know as the Great Wall of China, which was also in use for far longer than the mere 3 centuries or so of Hadrian's Wall. The wall lay on the fringe of Roman Britain, itself on the fringes of the Roman Empire, the frontiers of which ran for thousands of miles, along great rivers, through mountains and deserts. Hadrian's Wall was one small component of the empire's border control and defence, and rarely would it have occupied the thoughts of the emperors who ruled this vast empire. All this is true, but the wall is still special because it is unlike any other Roman frontier. Nowhere else were the defences so elaborate or monumental in scale. Nor is there so much archaeology to see in so small an area. In a way, The wall figures larger in our sense of the Roman world than it surely did to the Romans, much as provincial and rather vulgar Pompeii and the more sophisticated Herculaneum have shaped our ideas of Roman city life and art because of the catastrophe that led to their remarkable preservation. Because so much of the ancient world is lost forever, the sites that survive often assume far greater importance than they ever possessed when they were living communities. In 1987, Hadrian's Wall was named a UNESCO World Heritage Site, incorporated into the broader Frontiers of the Roman Empire World Heritage Site in 2005, which acknowledged its importance. Over 90% of it is now invisible on the ground, and yet, even so, it is the largest of the many monuments left by the Roman Empire, and one of the most famous. It is also one of the most frequently visited, drawing people to walk the Hadrian's Wall path, or look at the excavated remains of forts and the wall itself. If it lacks the intimate detail and dramatic story of Pompeii and Herculaneum, or the obvious history and importance of Rome itself, or the spectacles of theatres, amphitheatres, temples or aqueducts dotted around the old empire, still tens of thousands come every year to see it. Most go to the central sector, where more of the wall is exposed, and it snakes across a landscape of dramatic ridges and crags. It is very rare to see a photograph of other sections of the wall, so people are usually surprised to learn that for most of its length it crossed gentler, rolling countryside, or that in the far west its last few miles ran close to the sea along the shore of the Solway Firth. The wall itself was also part of a much larger network that included military bases, towns, and roads to the north and south, and military installations along the Cumbrian coast in the west. Because it was occupied by the Romans for the best part of 300 years, generations of soldiers and civilians, of provincials and local peoples, lived their lives on and around the wall and the broad military zone it created. In most people's minds, the purpose of any wall is fairly simple, especially one of the sheer size of Hadrian's Wall. A wall is a barrier, dividing one side from the other, and for many the idea persists that it was built to keep the Scots out, or Picts, for those with slightly more sense of history. Hadrian's Wall can be seen as the end of the empire, where civilization stopped and barbarism began, although today's fashionable hostility to empires no doubt will incline many to sympathize more with the so-called barbarians. Archaeologists know that the truth is different, and a good deal more complicated. But they will also admit that there is much about the wall, its purpose and its operation, that we do not understand. Only a tiny fraction of the literature of the ancient world has survived into the modern era. These texts mention Hadrian's Wall no more than a handful of times, and the sole surviving statement about its purpose claims that Hadrian built the wall to separate the barbarians from the Romans. The comment is brief and was written down some 200 years later by an author notorious for his inaccuracy and inventions, so that it is a sign of the extreme poverty of sources that we make use of it at all. It is only in recent years that we have evidence that it may indeed have been named after the emperor who ordered its construction, although using his family name Aelius rather than Hadrianus. The Wallum Aelium, or Wall of Aelius, kept this name for only a generation or so, and afterwards was simply called the Wallum. Hadrian's Wall can only be understood by examination of its physical remains, backed by inscriptions, finds from the sites along it, and comparison with what we understand of the Roman army and the Roman world from other places and sources. Yet no other Roman frontier was quite like Hadrian's Wall, making direct analogy difficult, while debates over its function strike to the heart of wider debates over how the Roman Empire worked. Excavation has provided a lot of information, even though older reports are often frustratingly vague in their recording and the result of less sophisticated methods. Archaeological investigation is expensive, and these days funding is in short supply, and work on the wall is less fashionable than it deserves to be. Even so, where work occurs, it continues to produce surprises that fundamentally alter our understanding of the wall. Frustratingly incomplete as our evidence is, we face an even greater problem because almost all of it deals solely with the Roman side of things. The Iron Age peoples living to the north of the wall are poorly understood. Roman sources give us the names of tribes and some places, but we can never be sure whether these reflect the reality, because outsiders so often misunderstand other cultures. Far more settlements have been located than used to be known, suggesting that at least some parts of what would become Scotland were relatively densely populated, while environmental evidence suggests that some regions were also extensively cultivated for some of the Roman period. Iron Age sites are difficult to date with the sort of precision that might allow us to relate developments in settlement north of the wall to the Roman frontier's purpose and day-to-day functioning. We really do not know enough about the political and military practices of the tribes to describe the threat they posed to the Romans, or for that matter, the threat the Romans posed to them. Wars were fought between the Romans and the tribes in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries AD, but, as we shall see, very little is known about any of them. Raiding appears to have been common, perhaps universal, in Iron Age Europe. So we would expect to find this small-scale military activity in northern Britain. But extending what we know of Celtic society elsewhere, which in itself comes largely from the viewpoint of Greco-Roman outsiders, to the peoples of the north must only be done with caution. Linguistic links may not necessarily reflect a common political and military culture, but in the end we simply do not know. Thus, we must do our best to reconstruct the story of Hadrian's Wall, knowing that at most we have mere glimpses of only one side of the story. Whatever military threat existed, or was perceived by the Romans, can only be conjectured by looking at the methods they used to deal with it. With Hadrian's Wall, there are few definite answers, many theories, and even more questions. This book cannot hope to explore them all in detail, but its aim is to give an idea of how scholars try to understand the wall and its place in the wider history of Roman Britain. Rather than qualify every statement, sometimes the book will reflect my own judgment on the most likely interpretation. My central premise is that Hadrian's Wall and all the installations associated with it were intended to assist the Roman army in performing the tasks assigned to it in northern Britain. Soldiers were not there to serve the wall, but the wall was there to serve them. This may seem obvious, but there is always a danger that physical remains take over our thoughts at the expense of the human beings whose activities and lives leave less tangible reminders. The sheer scale and longevity of Hadrian's Wall make it clear that it performed a practical function, and that, at least most of the time, it performed it well. That much we can say with confidence. But understanding just what that function was, and how it developed over time, is much like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle when most of the pieces are missing, and without the picture on the box to serve as a guide. Note on measurements. 1 Roman mile equals 1,618 yards, or 0.92 imperial, or US miles equals 1.479 kilometers. 1 Roman foot equals 11.64 imperial, or US inches, equals 29.6 centimetres. Wall miles. In the 20th century, a scholarly convention was created to ease the identification of sections of Hadrian's Wall and the installations along it. This was based around numbering mile castles from 0 at Wall's End in the east to 80 at Bowness-on-Solway in the west. The stretch between each mile castle became a wall mile, with wall mile 1 beginning at Wall's End and extending westwards. All numbers of turrets and mile castles derive from this system. 1. Britannia, outpost of empire. Britain was a late addition to the Roman Empire, conquered at a time when expansion was becoming rare, but the actual conquest in AD 43 was not the first military contact between the Empire and the Britons. Almost a century before, Julius Caesar, then proconsul, or governor, of Gaul, landed in the southeast in 55 BC, and again in 54 BC. He beat down the fierce resistance of the local tribes and accepted their submission, but did not choose to stay over the winter and never returned. News of Caesar's expeditions to the mysterious, almost mythical island that lay out in the encircling oceans surrounding the three continents known to the Greeks and Romans was greeted at Rome with euphoria, on a scale almost akin to the moon landing in 1969. The Senate suspended public business for 20 days of official thanksgiving, an unprecedented celebration, far grander than any awarded to mark victories in much more important wars in the past. Practical results and profits were less impressive. The orator Cicero noted that there was no silver, nor booty except for slaves, but I doubt we'll find any scribes or musicians amongst them. Caesar was one of the gifted and ambitious commanders who conquered large swathes of territory on behalf of Rome's Republic. Rome was founded in the 8th century BC, at first one small Latin city among many. Over time it grew, displaying from very early on a unique talent for absorbing others. By the 3rd century BC, Rome controlled virtually all of the Italian peninsula, and hundreds of thousands of people who were not ethnically Latin, let alone Roman, were Roman citizens. Former enemies became allies, and after a generation or so, often citizens who shared in the responsibilities and profits of expansion. Rome's Republic was led in peace and war by elected magistrates, drawn from the wealthiest citizens and predominantly from a small group of aristocratic families. Former magistrates provided the bulk of the Senate, some 600 senior statesmen, whose role was to advise and guide the magistrates and the popular assemblies, which actually had the power to pass laws. The system was designed to prevent any individual or group from gaining permanent supreme power, which meant that many provincial governors went out to their provinces eager to win glory in the short time before they were replaced. Aggression and conquest were not constant, but over time the empire controlled by the Roman Republic grew. In the 2nd century BC, the Republic came to dominate the Mediterranean, and soon its legions advanced far from its shores. Conquests brought vast wealth and glory to a few of the aristocracy, raising them above their peers and putting a heavy strain on the system. Men like Caesar greatly increased the pace of conquest, but they were also leaders in the succession of civil wars that tore the republican system of government apart. Most died violently. In Caesar's case, he was stabbed to death at a meeting of the Senate. Civil war resumed soon afterwards, ending only when Mark Antony's suicide in 30 BC left Caesar's great-nephew and heir as the last remaining warlord. Caesar Augustus, as he was soon to be named, became Rome's first emperor, although he styled himself as princeps, first citizen and first servant of the state, so that scholars refer to the rule of Rome's emperors as the principate. Ultimately, his power rested on control of the army, a permanent, professional force of around 300,000 men, divided almost equally between the citizen soldiers of the legions and the provincial and foreign auxiliaries. Every soldier swore an oath of loyalty to the princeps, and it was from the emperor that all pay and promotion came. Augustus cleansed himself of his bloody rise to power by giving Romans and provincials internal peace and constant victory against foreign enemies. Almost everyone was desperate for stability and prosperity after decades of civil war and massacre, so they were willing to accept the dominance of one man as better than any likely alternative. In spite of frequent severe illnesses, Augustus outlived almost all his contemporaries, and over time forgot the man who had slaughtered his way to the top, and instead saw only the peacemaker and father of his country. Victories over foreign enemies made Rome safe and its empire wealthy, something that all patriotic Romans could celebrate. And Augustus provided a constant stream of such successes. By his death, Rome's empire was largely complete, bounded by the Atlantic in the west, the Rhine, the Danube and the Euphrates in the east, the Sahara Desert in the south, and the Channel Coast in the north. Just before he died in AD 14, a little short of his 77th birthday, Augustus advised his successor to keep the empire within its present boundaries. Whether or not he meant to bring a permanent halt to expansion, or just give the empire a period of rest and recovery, further conquest became rare. Few emperors were inclined to trust a major command to a senator who might thus win glory and popularity with the soldiers, turning him into a rival. Even fewer emperors wanted to spend years on campaign, conquering new lands. Although poets, such as Horace, had spoken with eager anticipation of the conquest of Britain, "Augustus will be deemed a god on earth when the Britons have been added to our empire," they were to be disappointed. There was a good deal of trade across the Channel, and some diplomatic activity, exiled British princes fleeing to the empire for sanctuary, but no new invasion. Augustus had counted the tribes of the southeast as allies, who acknowledged Rome's supremacy and were thus part of the empire, even though they were not ruled directly, an attitude he extended to the great Parthian Empire, modern Iran and Iraq, in the east, and even the peoples of India. A little later, the geographer Strabo declared that Britain was not worth conquering, for it posed no threat, and the revenue to be gained from taxing the tribes was unlikely to cover the cost of the army needed to subdue the island. Such concerns weighed less with the Emperor Claudius than his need for military glory. In the chaos after the assassination of his nephew Caligula in AD 41, Praetorian guardsmen discovered Claudius hiding behind a curtain in the imperial palace. As the well-paid and pampered household troops of the emperor, they needed an emperor, any emperor, and so proclaimed him, because he was the only adult male member of Augustus's family available. There were few other grounds for his selection, but the Senate was forced to accept him because its members could not defy the armed strength of the Praetorians. Claudius was 51, stammered, drooled, and limped, and could boast of little public service and no military achievements. In AD 43, Claudius decided to make up for this utter lack of military experience and gathered 4 legions out of the 28 then in service, reinforcing them with auxiliaries, sailors, and other troops, and invaded Britain. The first target was the great tribal confederation dominating the southeast. Claudius arrived in person to oversee the capture of their capital at Camulodunum, Colchester, although he stayed in Britain for less than 2 weeks. His victory was celebrated in lavish style, not least because he had completed a task begun by his ancestor, the great Julius Caesar. The island the Romans called Britannia was home to many separate peoples, divided into tribes. Conflict between tribes was common, and internal power struggles almost as frequent, and there was no sense that they all belonged to a common nation. When the Romans arrived, many leaders chose to ally with the invaders, seeing them as less of a threat than their neighbours and traditional enemies. In AD 60, the province was devastated by a rebellion provoked by the mistreatment of just such an ally, Queen Boudica of the Iceni, who sacked the veteran colony established at Camulodunum, the flourishing commercial town of Londinium, London, and the tribal centre at Verulamium, St. Albans. Some tribes joined the revolt, while others stayed loyal. After those early successes, Boudica was defeated in battle, and the rebellion suppressed with considerable savagery. This was followed by conciliation, and it is striking that lowland Britain never again witnessed any revolt against Roman rule over the next 3.5 centuries. It took longer for the Romans to secure control over what would become Wales, where there were frequent campaigns until the AD 70s, and a strong military presence for some time after that. Simultaneously, northern England was overrun, and garrisons established in the area where Hadrian's Wall would later be built. Recent dendrochronological analysis of timbers used to build the first Roman fort at Carlisle, Lugavalium, show that the trees were felled in AD 72 or 73. Cneius Julius Agricola, governor of Britain in AD 78 to 84, pushed ever farther north, driving deep into Scotland, where he routed an army of Caledonian tribesmen at Mons Graupius, the location of which is unknown. Permanent occupation was planned, and a network of forts was built, most notably the fortress at Inchtethil in Perthshire, intended to house an entire legion. Unexpectedly, plans changed after a series of military crises on the Rhine and Danube frontiers. These, and not Britain, became the priorities for the Emperor Domitian, AD 81 to 96, receiving the bulk of his attention and available resources. One of the four legions, and probably many auxiliaries, were posted away from the province, and this substantial reduction in troop numbers prompted withdrawal from all bases north of the line between the estuaries of the rivers Forth and Clyde, and close to the area where the modern cities of Edinburgh and Glasgow now stand. Coin evidence suggests that this occurred around AD 86 to 87. At Inchtuthil, a few of the internal buildings had not even been started before the base was evacuated, the defences slighted and the buildings demolished. The abandonment of these garrisons appears to have been ordered and not caused by hostile action, and the withdrawal may have been phased over a few years, with the line of towers and outposts along the Gask Ridge being occupied a little longer before that, too, was decommissioned. Very little is known about Britain during the reign of the Emperor Trajan, AD 98 to 117. Sites that would be closely associated with the wall, such as Corbridge, Coria, Vindolanda, Carvaran and Carlisle, were garrisoned, and fascinating glimpses of life in the garrisons are supplied by the writing tablets found at Carlisle, and especially at Vindolanda. Early in the 2nd century AD, small outposts or fortlets were constructed in this area, notably the sites at Haltwhistle Burn and Throp, and perhaps some towers for observation or signalling. Around AD 106, the most northerly base left in Scotland, the fort at Newstead, Trimontium, was abandoned, as were other outposts. A properly laid out, stone-paved and drained Roman road, known from its medieval name as the Stanegate, because we do not know what the Romans called any of the roads they made in Britain, was constructed, running at least from Corbridge to Carlisle, each of which lay on major north-south roads. It ran a little to the south of where the wall would be built, following the natural and easiest route between the Tyne and Eden valleys. At some point there was another drastic reduction in the size of the army of the provinces, when Legio IX, or often on inscriptions in the old-fashioned form as V1111, Hispana was withdrawn, leaving just two legions in garrison, 2 Augusta and 20 Valeria Victrix. Trajan was one of the last great conquerors, adding Dacia, modern Romania, to the empire, and in the last years of his life invading Parthia. Britain does not appear to have figured highly on his list of priorities, and its governors had to do their job with substantially reduced military resources. Overstretch is the most likely reason for the withdrawal to the Tyne-Solway line in these years, and the concentration of a number of garrisons in this area effectively created a rough frontier line. In the years that followed, this was enhanced by the addition of outposts and the Stanegate Road itself. There is little evidence for activity or any extension of the road to the east of Corbridge, and the focus of the army's attention appears to have been the central and western sectors, facing the peoples known as the Novanti and Selgovi. It is impossible to say how peaceful northern Britain was during Trajan's reign, but the presence of the bases along the Stanegate suggests that there was a real or perceived threat to Roman control and dominance in these areas. The strength report of a unit based at Vindolanda in the AD 90s includes 6 wounded men, vulnerati, unfit for duty. Although it is possible that they had been injured in an accident, this may hint at fighting, whether some small skirmish or a larger engagement. Another fragmentary writing tablet talks about the fighting styles of the local tribes. The Britons are unprotected by armour. There are very many cavalry. The cavalry do not use swords, nor do the Brituncoli mount or halt to throw javelins. There is also a tombstone, later reused in the 3rd century bathhouse at Vindolanda, commemorating the centurion Titus Annius, killed in the war, Interfectus in Bello. This probably dates to Trajan's reign, suggesting a reasonably large-scale conflict at some point to justify the use of the word war. One 4th century source claims that there were problems in Britain early in Hadrian's reign, making it possible that trouble had broken out in the last years of his predecessor, Trajan. All in all, and given Hadrian's actions and subsequent history, it seems wise to assume that the frontier area posed an ongoing problem to the Roman administration, for all the dismissive talk of Brituncoli or Little Britons. At Mons Graupius in AD 83 or 84, the Caledonians had mustered an army claimed, by our Roman source, to number well over 30,000 warriors. The noblemen came to battle in agile, fast-moving chariots, each pulled by a pair of ponies. Julius Caesar had expressed his wonder when he encountered similar vehicles in 55 BC, for they had fallen out of use in continental Europe at least a century earlier. Used for skirmishing and as a stylish and impressive way of travelling to and from a fight, the noble warrior would spring down from his chariot to fight on foot. Caesar said that the chariots were closely supported by groups of cavalry, although the latter are not mentioned in the single account of Mons Graupius. The bulk of the Caledonians were unarmored infantrymen, wielding blunt-tipped, slashing swords, their only protection a small shield. A sculpture from the Antonine Wall on the 4th Clyde line depicts a Roman cavalryman riding down three warriors very much like these, carrying little rectangular bucklers and long swords, although it is notable that the text from Vindolanda expressly states that the local horsemen did not carry swords. No doubt there was considerable variation between different communities and over the centuries. The peoples of the north never formed a permanent professional army in any way resembling the Roman army. Few men were full-time warriors in the sense that fighting and training to fight was their main occupation in life. Such men would have been the chieftains and their armed followers. As was the case among other Iron Age peoples in Gaul and elsewhere, it is probable that a leader's power was displayed by the number of warriors he kept in his household. The chiefs and such household warriors were likely to have the best equipment. These were men who rode in chariots, possessed good swords and perhaps mail armor or a helmet, and had the opportunity to train for war. In a small raid, the bulk or all of a force might consist of such well-equipped and highly motivated warriors. But in any larger army, these would be a small minority among the mass of ordinary tribesmen. Less well-equipped, the latter might be brave and have some familiarity with weapons, especially if violence and theft between and within tribes were common. However, they would not be disciplined or used to obeying the orders of their leaders. As a general rule, the larger the tribal army was, the more clumsily it moved and manoeuvred, giving the Romans even more of an advantage in larger-scale warfare. Raiding to seize cattle or captives, and perhaps also trophies as proof of manhood and prowess, was the most common form of military activity in the ancient world, and it is unlikely that northern Britain was an exception. The willingness and ability to plunder your neighbours, or their open submission to avoid such attacks, demonstrated to the wider world the strength of a leader or people. Caesar tells us of Germanic tribes that kept a depopulated strip of land around their borders as a warning to outsiders. This lower-level violence was probably the most common problem faced by the Roman army, whether it was directed against the Romans or their allies. The response over much of the empire was to assert dominance by proving that the empire and its army had a far greater capacity for violence than its enemies. The much-vaunted Roman peace was based on Roman victory and strength, and not the product of peaceful coexistence. Although such methods might intimidate, they also left a bitter legacy of hatred among the survivors of displays of Roman might, sowing the seeds for future conflict. 2. Hadrian, the man, the emperor, and the grand design. In August 117, the ailing Trajan died in Cilicia, modern southern Turkey. He was on his way back to Rome, his great eastern adventure having turned sour amid rebellions in the newly conquered territory and a simultaneous revolt of the Jewish population in Egypt, Cyprus, and Cyrenaica. Hadrian was the son of the emperor's cousin, who, like him, was also from Italica in Spain. His Latin was tinged with a provincial accent, but from his youth he had adored all things Greek, earning himself the nickname Graeculus, or Little Greek, and sported a neater version of a philosopher's beard. He was 41, a clever man, albeit far too keen to show off his cleverness, and the closest male relative of the childless emperor. Rumour said that he had seduced the wives of other senators so that he could learn about their plans, and so ease his rise to favour at the imperial court, but it was clear that the greatest passions in his life revolved around teenage boys. Trajan had shown Hadrian some favour, but he stopped a good way short of marking him out as his heir. The emperor's widow claimed that on his deathbed her husband had at long last adopted Hadrian and named him as his successor. Not everyone was convinced, and the rapid execution of four prominent senators back in Rome fueled suspicion, even though it deterred any open opposition. Hadrian was never truly popular with the Senate from then on, even though he was far from being a tyrant. Tact was not his strong point, and he lacked the ability to win affection from the nobility. For years, the emperor openly paraded his lover, the Bithynian youth Antinous, declaring the lad to be a god after he drowned in the Nile in somewhat mysterious circumstances. Affairs of this sort were supposed to be discreet, not exuberantly public, and this only added to the secret resentment felt by most aristocrats. Hadrian does not appear to have cared much about the feelings of others. He spent lavishly on a major remodeling of Athens, but crowned his achievement with an arch bearing the inscription, "This is the city of Hadrian, not of Theseus," the city's mythical founder. Insecure, given the doubts over his right to rule and his unpopularity, Hadrian had no desire to spend years regaining and securing territory in the east, and thus most of Trajan's recent conquests were abandoned. There were to be no wars of expansion under Hadrian, but it was vital to retain the loyalty of the army and to demonstrate Rome's continued military dominance. So he spent much of his reign touring the provinces and visiting the legions, watching them at drill, praising and rewarding them. No emperor since Augustus had travelled as much as Hadrian would during his reign, visiting almost every part of the empire. Such travel could be arduous, and he was praised for his endurance as well as the personal example he set, leading soldiers on route marches and eating the same rations issued to them. Hadrian had a mind for detail, and although he chose not to lead his soldiers in war, he was keen to show a deep interest in their lives, imposing strict discipline, but moderating it with fair treatment and generous rewards for talented officers and men. In Britain, Hadrian was faced with an outbreak of warfare, possibly inherited from his predecessor. An experienced governor from the Danube frontier was sent to take charge and achieved victory within a few years. In 122, another proven commander, Aulus Platorius Nepos, took over, arriving by July the 17th, one of those rare precise dates, in this case derived from a document issued to a discharged soldier. At some point during the same year, Hadrian went to Britain in person, staying for a few months. Around the same time, the provincial garrison was increased in size by the addition of a third legion, 6 Victrix. Hadrian's personal involvement in the decision to construct the wall and in its design is clear. It is generally assumed that he gave the order after visiting the area, so that the surveying and construction began no earlier than 122. However, we know little about Roman planning methods and imperial decision-making, and cannot be sure that the project was not devised, and perhaps even begun, earlier than this, so that the visiting emperor could come and inspect progress. Timber used to construct a stockade along a section of the frontier in Germany was felled 2 years before Hadrian visited the region in 121, so it is possible there was a similar advance order in Britain. The initial design for Hadrian's Wall was grand, if not as grand as it would become, and this is an indication of the emperor's personal involvement. Hadrian was obsessed with architecture and loved designing great buildings, a passion reflected in his rebuilding of the Pantheon in Rome, with its spectacular domed roof, and in his sprawling villa complex at Tivoli. The wall was more functional, but it made up for this in sheer size. The western section, for 31 Roman miles, approximately 46 kilometres, from Bowness-on-Solway was built of turf, timber and earth, with a rampart some 20 feet, 6 metres, wide at its base. The line was then continued by a stone wall for 49 Roman miles, approximately 73 kilometres to the east, eventually ending at Wall's End on the Tyne. This wall was planned to be about 10 feet, 3 metres wide, and was freestanding, unlike the stone walls sometimes used in forts that were backed by an earth bank. Every Roman mile there was to be a mile castle, a small fortlet, its north wall part of the wall itself, and both north and south walls having a gateway. Between the mile castles, and also forming part of the wall itself, were two turrets, which were built in stone, even on the turf wall. Throughout its length, the wall was fronted by a wide and deep ditch, except where nature provided an even more formidable protection in the form of a cliff. To the west and then south of Bowness-on-Solway, following the coastline of Cumbria, the pattern of stone turrets and turf and timber fortlets continued for about 20 miles, but in this case there was no continuous wall or ditch. The surveyors marking out the line of the wall appear to have begun near the coasts and worked inland. Construction work was undertaken by detachments drawn from the three legions, and there are hints of slight variations in the templates used by each one, even though we cannot allocate them to specific units. The wall was not built section by section, completing everything before moving on to the next piece. Instead, parties started to build at locations all along the line, sometimes laying down no more than foundations and perhaps a few courses of stone, and elsewhere completing work, especially on turrets and mile castles. The turf wall in the west is likely to have been completed first, for the methods involved were faster and familiar to all the soldiers. Most army bases were made using the same methods. It also seems that priority was given to the curtain wall, the wall itself, rather than the turrets and mile castles along it, in the sector running through the gentler country on the eastern side, especially from wall miles 7 through 22. In the rugged central section, there was more concern to build turrets, and probably the northern wall of mile castles, which most likely had a tower over the gateway. This suggests a line of raised sentry stations, each capable of signalling back to a fort on the Stanegate Road just to the south. Mile castles near the routes along the river valleys, cutting through the planned line of the wall, also came early in the schedule, guarding country readily infiltrated by raiders. Many turrets and mile castles were built with short sections of curtain wall abutting them, making it easier to bond with the main wall when it was finally joined to them. Major changes to the design of the wall were then made, whether by Hadrian in person if his visit was to inspect a project already underway, or after consultation with him if it was only begun in 122. In the original design, only the small detachments of troops in mile castles and turrets garrisoned the wall itself, and substantial numbers were stationed at a mile or two to the rear in the forts on the Stanegate. There is no good evidence as yet for garrisons behind the eastern section of the wall, but it is usually assumed that these existed or were planned on a similar scale to the bases on the Stanegate in the central and western sections. Whether or not this assumption is correct, a decision was then made that the number of troops serving near the wall was to be drastically increased by the addition of forts actually on the curtain wall, each designed to hold a complete auxiliary unit. As with the whole project, the new forts were not all constructed at the same time, and again, as with the wider project, over the course of time there were changes made to their specific design. At first, the new forts were laid out so that they projected well to the north of the wall, with three out of the four main fort gateways beyond it, increasing the number of crossings giving access to the north. Presumably, this was judged to be excessive, and forts built later in the sequence lie behind the curtain, so that it forms their northern wall, and there is only one grand double gateway leading through the wall and giving access to the north. Eventually, there were 15 forts on the wall, each about 7 to 7.5 miles, 10.5 to 11.5 kilometres, apart, with at least three more on the line of the Stanegate continuing in full use for most of the life of the wall. There are hints at interruptions in the building schedule, perhaps of changing priorities. Some sections of foundation or low walls appear to have been left open to the weather for one or more seasons before building resumed. It was difficult to build a freestanding wall much higher than about 5 feet without employing scaffolding, and the timber needed to make this scaffolding for so vast a project is likely to have been the biggest restriction on its progress. Much of this region, especially on the coastal plains, had been cleared of forest in the pre-Roman Iron Age by local farmers, so that less wood was readily available. Long stretches of the wall were built over ploughed fields, the marks of the ploughing still there beneath the earliest layers of Roman occupation. At Housesteads and Chesters, construction of the forts required the demolition of turrets that had already been completed and show signs of occupation. In other cases, forts lay on top of planned or even completed mile castles. Excavations at Bodoswald have shown that the rampart of the turf wall was used to fill in the ditch so that the fort could be built over it. In this case, the site was wooded, making it the exception to the general pattern of construction over cleared farmland. The timber felled to clear the site was immediately used in construction of the fort. Like mile castles, forts were built in the same material as each sector of curtain wall, turf and timber in the west and stone in the east. The only exception to this was that in early phases of the stone forts, some internal buildings were timber. Another change made soon after the decision to add forts was a reduction in the width of the wall itself to around 7 feet 6 inches, 2.29 meters. Scholars term this the narrow wall, as opposed to the broad wall. It is unclear how much broad wall was ever completed to full height, but the decision to reduce the gauge of the curtain greatly reduced the time and material needed in construction. Some mile castles were wholly or partly built to broad wall widths, whereas others were wholly narrow wall, providing evidence for the order in which they were constructed. After the fort decision was taken, although before all forts were planned and constructed, another feature was added behind almost the entire length of the wall. This is known as the walum, because in the 8th century, the Anglo-Saxon monk Bede mistook it for an earlier earth wall. Its principal feature is a ditch, so the name ought to be fossa, but walum has stuck and is still used by scholars. The ditch of the walum was about 20 feet, 6 meters wide, with sloping sides so that its flat bottom was somewhat narrower. Spoil from the ditch was raised into a 20-foot-wide mound on either side, set back some 30 feet, 9 meters, from the edges. The width of all the walum's elements appears to match a Roman measurement known as an actus of 120 Roman feet, approximately 35.5 meters. For much of its length, the walum ran close to the wall, widening to allow room for mile castles and forts, but in the central section it stayed on the lower ground rather than climbing the crags, so that the interval between the wall and walum was wider. There were causeways across the walum for each fort, and a handful are known to have been added to permit access from certain mile castles through the North Mound. The north-south Roman road known today as Deer Street, after its Anglo-Saxon name, and providing the foundations for the modern A68 road, was provided with both a crossing over the walum and its own gateway through the wall to the west of Milecastle 22, and similar provision is assumed for the other major north-south road running via Carlisle. As ever, the precise sequence of decisions and construction can only be guessed. At some point later in Hadrian's reign, the stretch of turf wall for several miles to the west of the River Irthing near Bodoswald was replaced in stone, as was the fort itself. There may have been a substantial pause in construction, and similar halts occurred elsewhere, if not necessarily at the same time. There is evidence for heavy fighting under Hadrian, apart from the war at the start of his reign, and various dates have been suggested for this, notably approximately 123 to 124 or later in the decade. The need to draw troops away for active campaigning is an attractive explanation for such lulls in building work, as is the idea that the Romans' new fortification and stronger military presence provoked hostility in the people of the area. But there could be other explanations as well, for the army was given many tasks and had limited manpower. The extension of the observation system to the Cumbrian coast does suggest a real threat, presumably of raiders coming by boat and bypassing the wall altogether. We shall examine each element of the wall in more detail, but it is worth noting that in its original and modified designs, Hadrian's wall was a formidable obstacle to unauthorized movement. It was not meant to hinder the Roman army, which controlled its numerous crossing points. Compared to other Roman frontiers, the system is on a far grander scale. The line Hadrian ordered built in Germany was a simple stockade fence with a ditch behind it, an obstacle to slow down anyone trying to cross it, but nothing more. 3. Building and manning the wall. Legions and auxilia. The Roman army was based around the legions recruited from Roman citizens. There were 30 of these when the wall was built, so the garrison of Britain represented 1/10 of the entire legionary strength of the empire. Each legion had a theoretical strength of around 5,000 men, almost all of whom were heavily armed infantrymen. These were organized into 10 cohorts, each consisting of 6 centuries of 80 men who were commanded by a centurion. The first cohort was different, having 5 double-strength centuries and the task of guarding the precious eagle standard of the legion. The legions were supported by the auxilia, men recruited from the provinces who would gain citizenship only at the end of their military service. The auxilia included both infantry and cavalry, as well as specialized troops such as archers. They were not divided into legion-sized formations, but formed in independent units similar in size to a legionary cohort. There were infantry cohorts of 480 or 800 men, mixed cohorts, cohortes equitati, of 480 infantry and 120 horsemen, or 800 infantry and 240 horsemen, and cavalry, ali, all cavalry regiments, of 512 or 768, respectively. From Augustus onwards, there were at least as many auxiliaries as legionaries, and by the 2nd century AD, there were significantly more. Overall, the garrison of Britain probably had a theoretical strength of more than 35,000 men, making it larger than the army in almost every other province of the empire. It was commanded by the provincial governor, Legatus Augusti, a senator, usually at least in his 40s, and who had already held command in a less prestigious military province. Although legionaries were Roman citizens, only a tiny minority of them came from Italy, and most were from the substantial communities of citizens living in Gaul, Spain, North Africa, and other provinces. Auxiliaries were organized into units with ethnic names, for instance, Spaniards, Gauls, Dacians, Thracians, Hamians from Syria, and Batavians and Tongrians from the Rhineland. When first raised, auxiliary units were recruited from these peoples. Over time, especially when a unit was posted far from its homeland, it is clear that men from other races enlisted and served. The language of command and administration in all units was Latin, although Hadrian encouraged units to keep ethnic war cries. Britons served in distinct units, but were also present in many other cohorts and ali stationed on the wall. Some units had simple titles, such as Cohors II Delmatarum Ec, or the 2nd Part-Mounted Regiment of Delmati, which was recruited from modern-day Croatia and served at Carvoran in the 3rd century, or Cohors I Hamiorum Sagittariorum, or the 1st Regiment of Hamian Archers, which had been at the same fort under both Hadrian, then on the Antonine Wall in the 140s and 150s, and then back at Carvoran under Marcus Aurelius. A few units acquired additional titles as rewards for valor or loyalty. Thus, there was the Ala Augusta ob Virtutem Appellata, the cavalry regiment called Augustan on account of its valor, and the even more elaborately named Ala Augusta Gallorum Petriana Miliaria Civium Romanorum, or double-strength cavalry regiment of Gauls, originally raised by Petrianus, the emperor's own, of Roman citizens. Granting citizenship to an entire regiment of soldiers was a rare reward for conspicuous service. The grant only applied to soldiers currently serving with the unit, but the unit title of Roman citizens was kept permanently, even when all the men who had been made citizens had served their time and been discharged from the army. In the 2nd century AD, most recruits were volunteers, with only occasional periods of conscription, often when auxiliary units were raised as part of a treaty with a tribe, or when a major war occurred. All had to be free-born, for the army was not supposed to be a refuge for runaway slaves. Army pay was similar to the wages of a farm labourer, but it was regular, and soldiers were fed, clothed, and provided with better medical care than the poor in civilian life. Literate recruits stood a good chance of promotion, which brought better pay and conditions. All this was set against extremely harsh discipline and a minimum enlistment of 25 years. Even the food and clothes issued to soldiers came at a price deducted from their pay. Officers were drawn from higher up the social scale than the men they commanded, and the most senior were invariably citizens of considerable status. In charge of each legion was a legate, legatus legionis, who was a senator, usually in his early 30s, supported by a senior tribune in his late teens who was just starting a senatorial career. Equestrians, or knights, equites, the next social class below senators, provided the bulk of the army's senior officers. Typically, such men first commanded an auxiliary cohort, then became one of 5 junior tribunes in each legion, before receiving the command of a cavalry ala. The officer commanding an auxiliary cohort, or ala, was called a prefect, praefectus, except in the case of some more prestigious units, where his title was tribune. Senators were obliged to own land in Italy, although many, like Hadrian, had grown up in the provinces. Equestrians came from all over the empire, and were men of considerable property and education. A few chose to serve instead as legionary centurions, but most centurions in the legions and the auxilia lacked equestrian status. Even so, they had to be highly literate, and many appear to have come from the minor gentry of Italy and the provinces, serving all or most of their time in the army as centurions. Centurion was not a specific rank, but a grade of officer whose responsibilities, pay, and status varied considerably. Much less is known about the background and careers of auxiliary as opposed to legionary centurions. The Roman army was very much the army of the empire, recruited from the provinces and led by men from the imperial elite. Soldiers usually served their entire 25 years with the same unit, and increasingly often that unit remained in the same province for generation after generation. In contrast, senatorial and equestrian officers moved from posting to posting around the empire, and many legionary centurions also served in a succession of different units in different provinces. This meant that northern Britain, like any frontier zone, drew men from far afield to serve there, the more senior usually only for short tours. In the 2nd century AD, a significant minority of the Senate's 600 members had been to Britain, and many had been to the north. Although on the edge of the empire, the sheer size of the provincial garrison meant that Britain was always important, its governorship a rare honour reserved only for the most distinguished and loyal senators. Hadrian's Wall was built by legionaries, the work being divided up and allocated to sub-units that then commemorated what they had done in simple inscriptions. From the 5th cohort, the century of Caecilius Proculus built this. Cohortis 5 Centuria, Caecili Proculi. Or, the 6th legion built this. Legio 6 Victris. Every legion included a large number of specialists and craftsmen, with other soldiers providing more or less skilled labour. An inscription from the Walum recording work done by an auxiliary cohort suggests that this huge but simpler task was allocated to these soldiers, whose units generally contained a much lower proportion of specialists. In later years, auxiliaries would undertake more complex building projects, especially in the forts. The wall itself was a simple structure, and the reliance on legionaries to build it has more to do with these bigger units being easier to organize on a large scale than auxiliary units one-tenth of their size. Stone was quarried from the nearest available source, usually less than 2 miles, approximately 3 kilometers, from the site. Squared rubble, the term used by stonemasons for stones more or less roughly squared off rather than precisely worked, was used for the 2 facing walls, with a core of smaller stones bonded with clay. The curtain wall was not particularly well made by Roman standards, so the priority was to complete this immense structure as quickly as possible. Some of the stone used was of very poor quality, so that in patches it was barely squared off at all. More care was given to the important features, such as turrets, buildings, and especially the gateways in forts and mile castles. These required considerably more skill than building the wall itself, which suggests that all the best craftsmen and teams were assigned to these tasks, leaving the bulk of other work to be performed by the less skilled legionaries and supervising engineers. Interruptions in the process